Like, it's utter load of bullshit, the rhetoric that's in the kind of startup ecosystem right now. It's work-life balance. If you want work-life balance, just get a normal life. Don't take 20 million quid of other people's money and ask for it.
How are you? Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. This week, my guest is Mark Abraham, the founder of Shackle. They've raised over $20 million and they believe they're going to be bigger than Airbnb. Mark's an Irish guy based out of Dubai. Today, we hear how he tragically lost his co-founder within a couple of months of starting the business, why he believes work-life balance is a complete myth, and why he chose the Middle East as the place to build his startup business. This is my chat with Mark Abraham, the founder of Shackle. Ever find yourself jumping from task to task? Sudden eureka moments at the weirdest hours, and you forget little details? Does that sound familiar? That might be ADHD, and ADHD Now are here to help. Their experienced clinical professionals conduct video consultations at your schedule and help you manage and understand these symptoms, turning them into your unique assets. Visit adhdnow.ie/fox and use the code FOX10 at checkout for 10% discount on your initial consultation and full assessment. I've got a massive ambition for this podcast. I want to make this the number one business podcast in the world. If I'm going to do that, I got to be world-class on every single level. And that includes having a world-class studio, which I now have at iconic offices, The Green Room. It's an incredible space. I first recorded here with my live pod back in June, and I loved it. And get this, it's publicly bookable. That means you can go online and book it right now. As I said, it's called The Green Room. It's a private cinema and screening room. That means it's perfect to wow a client with a pitch, host a private screening, or do what I do, record a podcast here. So, as I record here, and as you know, I'm a member of Iconic Offices, I've got the team at Iconic Offices to hook us up with a number of exclusive complimentary office trials and discounts for my audience for booking this exact space. No catches. Simply go to the web link in the description, grab the offer that works best for you. Thanks, Iconic Offices. I'm building much more than a podcast with the Entrepreneur Experiment and have a very clear vision of what I'm trying to achieve. One of those goals was to get involved in funding Irish businesses, and I've just achieved that goal. I've joined the Quintus Capital team as a special advisor to the EIIS Innovation Fund. I spent the last couple of years getting to know the team, learning about the industry, and the time has come to join forces. The EIIS Innovation Fund has invested in several of the podcast guests you know and love already, such as Matthew and Katie from Squid and Peggy Crowley of Brown Wellbeing, which has made the decision to join the fund a really, really simple one. EIIS Tax Relief provides significant tax refunds to investors who back Irish SMEs. However, the main issue with EIS is finding the right companies to invest in. This is where the EIS Innovation Fund comes in. It has an experienced management team to allocate your capital. They're now raising capital for November and December to deploy in 2024. If you are interested in becoming an investor, please visit EIIS.fund, so EIIS.fund, or download a copy of the online brochure in the show notes. Mark, welcome to the pod.
Gary, thank you very much for having me on.
I was trying to remember when I last did a virtual recording, and I cannot remember. It was back in those days. We won't even talk about why it was back in those days. So welcome. You're my first guest in a very long time.
Well, after yesterday's antics, you might not want to do any more remote Zooms again.
I apologize
for that, but in the true spirit of a startup, let's talk about it.
I wasn't even going to bring it up. So, Mark, welcome. Delighted to chat to you.
No, delighted to chat with you, Gary. I heard so many good things off a lot of mutual friends, Rob Lips, that obviously put us in touch. So congrats on everything you do. It's admirable and even inspiring for some of my myself to see it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. It's it feels in the last 6 months things have changed, and it's by meeting people like yourself and Rob, and then just it's the network effect, right? The dots start to join together and you start to see where the pattern is going. So I guess start and give us a feel of where you're based, number one, because I think that's probably incredibly interesting. Number one, where are you based?
Yeah, I'm in Dubai right now. I've traveled quite a bit. You know, we'll get into it. I have a travel startup, so by the virtue of being in the travel industry, I tend to be in a lot of cities. The last few years, I was around New York and Miami, Amsterdam, London. But Dubai for us is quite an exciting opportunity. If you were to kind of pick a city that described what hotels are, you'd probably come to Dubai for anyone who hasn't been. Hotels are everywhere. One of the reasons is for the alcohol license, it's most of it is attached to a hotel. So all the best restaurants are linked with hotels or partnerships. So your whole life revolves around a hotel. If you want to chill out at the weekend, you're at a hotel. If you want to go for dinner with your partner, it's at a hotel. Meet some friends for a drink, it's at a hotel. Okay. For us, we really want to have our whole team, you know, that product loop of where our team are hanging out, coming back to the office. We're just in hotels. So we chose Dubai as our global HQ after doing our recent fundraising.
And how did you personally end up out there?
It was forced to some extent. I started my company in February 2020 in the hospitality industry.
We all know what happened there.
Happened, which we're not going to speak about. It was one of two cities. I stayed in London for that summer. The geniuses at the government who started the Eat Out to Help Out program in August had everyone thinking it was over, and they were trying to tempt us back into normal life. And then in September, they shut down again. So no business can operate with that bad leadership at the government level. So I was like, where are we going to go? It was between two cities. It was Miami and Dubai. They were the two cities that were open for business. I went to Dubai. The first email I sent was a cold email to, we can track back into it. I went to a hospitality university in Ireland, and a gentleman called Gerald Lawless, probably our most famous alumni. He's the founding CEO of Jumeirah Group. He built the Burj Al Arab. He kind of changed hospitality down here. He sits on my board today, but back in December 2020, he didn't know who I was until a cold email came in his inbox asking him for a coffee or breakfast. And he was the first gentleman I met when I came to Dubai, and very thankful he was, because that's what set it off. So that's when I first arrived here.
I want to just track back something there, because you said, it was two cities. It was Miami or Dubai. If people are stuck in London, generally they're like, what am I going to do? I wonder when this is over. Like, where does that kind of global thinking come from? Because that's very unique.
It's a good question, because I grew up on a farm about 20 minutes outside Tullamore. Like I say, I'm from Tullamore because it's the nearest civilization, but it's a 20-minute drive. My dad, my granddad, they come from a lineage of farmers. So, all I looked out my window was green fields, cows and pigs. So maybe it was the fact that I was confined in that rural upbringing, and Ireland is, an island to some extent. So if you're built with any sort of maybe mindset to do more, it's tough, right? You kind of have to leave, not to be disrespectful. You have probably the best entrepreneurs in Ireland who built global businesses. But I think if you were to speak to them, they didn't just fully stay in Ireland. They probably got on planes and traveled around the world. Ireland, unbelievable education system, incredible people. But for me, it was just like I had to leave. So I went to boarding school. My parents very much pushed me to go and explore. They got me into every single sport. So I was very much built to like just try different things. At 12, you're sent away to boarding school, so you kind of have to grow up quick. When I went to university, three of my years were working abroad. So I worked in Chicago for a year, I worked in Brussels for a year, and then I worked in London for a year.
Right.
So I was just used to it. I just see an airplane as a taxi. I always laugh at mom. She's like, where are you this week? And I'm like, I'm getting a taxi to Miami or to New York or to LA. I don't see it as a big deal. It's just a longer taxi for me.
So that was always in you, but then you chose a career to allow you to explore that. Is that how you figured it out?
The world's just so big. When I first moved to London at 22, I was like, London's where it's at. And then you go to New York and spend a year there and you're like, wow, New York's where it's at. And then every time you go to a new city, you just meet new people. And you said it at the start, your network compounds, and it there's a domino effect to it. Like, trust me, if you've been in a city for a few years and you think it's the best city, just move to another city. And like, your network just expands exponentially. And I haven't even touched on some of the places I want to go. I really want to get across to Japan and Asia, Australia. And the beauty of it is in essence, we can launch a city on any given day in any area that I'd like to personally. Obviously, it can't be too biased for myself. It has to be strategic for the business. But I do have a travel business that if there's a hotel in a city, which every city has many hotels, I can ultimately go to any city I'd like. So I suppose it's a bit driven by me, a bit driven by the business.
So did you studied hospitality? You say, is that hotel management, or what did you study in college?
Yeah, I'll give you a bit of a background. I was fortunate that my dad didn't push me to becoming a farmer. He actually wanted me to spread my wings. He was taken out of school at the age of 14, and he had to run two households and he became the man of the two households at a pretty young age. Very intelligent man. Nothing against farming, and he wouldn't say it out himself, but he could have done so much more. But he had a responsibility to his parents and to his kids, and he had to run the farm. But such a smart man. I get it from both my mom and dad. So he wanted me to fly away to some extent. You know, never drove a new car so he could get me into boarding school, never went on fancy holidays so he could send me on sports trips. Like, that was the sacrifice he made. So I certainly didn't want to waste it. But when I was going to university, if you track back, whatever it is, 12, 13 years ago, it was really like the era of the CV, you know, and we used to say we speak fluent French and we can say bonjour. And, you know, we were the club captain and we did all this charity work. So when I was looking at university degrees, I was like, what would look good on my CV? Thankfully, this has changed now. But back then it was all about the CV. I wanted to do economics. I wanted to be in business. I thought it was Wall Street that I wanted to go into. So I thought economics as an undergrad would be a good degree. And NUI Galway had this dual degree course with the Shannon College of Hotel Management. So you got your BCom with economics and you got your hotel management degree and you got to work abroad for 3 years.
Nice.
So it was a 5-year course.
Mm.
And I was like, this just looks so good on my CV. Let's go for it.
Also sounds pretty good as well, to be fair. When you're 18, you're like, I get all this qualification, then I get to travel around the world.
Yeah, and the training was incredible. So it was probably a bad choice for me personally because I hate authority. So I had a horrid time in school, and any teachers listening to this now will either shiver or laugh. But going to Shannon College Hotel Management, it's not like going to a normal university. We had to wear suits to university. We had to polish our shoes every day. We had to be cleanly shaven. We had to iron our shirts. We had roll call. They take off your blazer to make sure you didn't just iron this part of the shirt.
I would do that.
It was literally like going to, it was like going to the army, and we were in, you know, the west of Ireland across the Shannon Airport. So, and then at 19, you're sent away. I was at NH Hotels in Brussels beside the parliament, and your full-time work, like a full-time salary at 19. I was then at Trump Towers in Chicago at 21. And then it was Sofitel London at 23.
Wow.
All full-time jobs. You're really prepared for the real world. Again, no disrespect to anyone who does a traditional university degree, but you know there's a little bit more partying and
I think that's, and I'm a believer that the apprenticeship model should come back, especially for business and entrepreneurs, because I think you do a business degree, you haven't really done anything. You've read the books, and any entrepreneur who's built anything will tell you that just doesn't fly. I think there should be an apprentice program for entrepreneurs, should be an apprentice program for businesses, like exactly like you've done there, where a little bit of academic, but then you go out and you work hard under an experienced entrepreneur or business person for a year.
Highly recommend anyone listening right now, if they're thinking about what to study, I genuinely think you should look at the Shannon College of Hotel Management and that dual degree course. I don't think I could have gone straight into the real world because I was quite immature. I actually think I needed those 4 or 5 years to mature a little bit before you go into the workplace. So I'm not against university from a maturity perspective, especially for men. They probably mature at a slightly less rate than women do. So I'm still a big fan of university, but I think some of the courses are just a waste of money.
And when you finished your course, then what was the plan? Because you seem like a very driven dude, and I imagine you came out with a very specific plan.
I did. I wanted to get straight into finance. I was in hotels, I was in revenue management, I was working at Heathrow Airport at Sofitel. And I was like, I'm so close to the City of London, those big buildings with all those big brands on it in the world of finance. Truthfully, I couldn't get into any of the investment banks. So I got into a commercial foreign exchange company that worked with corporates who might have had sales in America, but they were operating in Ireland. So they had to, you know, sell their US dollars and bring it back into euros. And my job was to work with Irish companies who had foreign exchange exposure. It was incredible from a sales training perspective. You did a lot of cold calls, a lot of emails, a lot of LinkedIn messages, and you get a lot of no's. And I still got that element of being in the City of London and wearing my suit to work. And it was a great experience. Absolutely loved it. I got quite a good opportunity at a pretty young age, probably around 25. To join the British and Irish Trading Alliance as a commercial director. I'd met them during the foreign exchange job because I was looking at doing a partnership with them to work with their Irish companies. And this was around the time of Brexit. So it was really to keep Irish and British companies closely connected. And a lot of the Irish companies have built most of London, Ballymore, Lang O'Rourke, Coffee Construction, Gallagher Group. So there's a huge Irish contingent, Paraday, and part of London Irish. So again, amazing stepping stone. And I got to go to, we did a lot of events with the Irish ambassador in London and the British ambassador in Dublin. Just a great combination of government contacts with big business hitters, like Brian Comer, for example.
Did you get involved in that as kind of a strategic thing? Did you think, oh, this will strategically be good? Or is this just another kind of step on the ladder for you? What was your kind of thinking getting involved?
I never knew what I was good at until I suppose maybe the last few years, but it's just networking. It's just building relationships. And kind of when I mapped out how the world works, it is network driven. Who you know, or what do they say? Like, who you know is your net worth. Like, that's it. And the network I was getting at such a young age because of the role and because of the government contacts was incredible. And then I did a step up to what was called the Nth Degree Club, which is the world's leading fine dining club. And the members were like Rolls Royce and Fabergé and Oberfinch from Land Rover. And we went to like the Monaco Grand Prix and all of the best Michelin star restaurants.
What were you doing with these groups? Was this like a large networking group, or what was your role? Because that sounds like a dream kind of, I know it's probably a lot of time involved, but what were you actually doing?
I was commercial director again. So I would go and I would get someone like Fabergé to become a corporate sponsor of the fine dining club, or like an experiential events club. And then high net worth individuals would join as members, and then they might buy a Rolls Royce or buy a Fabergé egg, or, you know, whoever. We had a super yacht company as part of it as well. And that was just a level up of networking. You know, I'd gone from the farm to the Monaco Grand Prix. Like, my parents were like, who is this child? What is he up to? But that was just, again, was networking, networking, networking. But then it hit me and it said, I'm at these events and I'm at these Michelin star restaurants and I'm not with my friends, I'm not with my family. Like, I'm a glorified worker at them. It wasn't me who earned it. And I hate being given anything. I think there's a question coming up in our quick fire about being given money. Like, that's my worst nightmare. I won the lotto. I wouldn't even play it firstly, but I'd give it back. I hate being given anything. I have to feel like I earn it. So I just wanted to get back into the grind of building it myself to say I did it.
So you wanted to get into the world, but then when you got in there, you're like, no, I want to be the main character, not the side actor.
Not the main character in the sense of everyone knows who Mark is and this is what he's doing, but I want to book an incredible, I'm not afraid that like money makes life better. I'm not one of those guys who's saying it doesn't. Like, it definitely does. And I think people are just so idiotic when they say that. So I want to be able to bring my, you know, I brought Dad to the Ireland, New Zealand game, at the quarterfinals in Paris. That was we lost, horrific, but what an experience for me and my dad to hang out. I loved it. I did something in Spain with my mom for her 60th. Like, we have memories for life. It's in our little photo book now. That wasn't for free, but I don't want to be doing it with, you know, commercial directors of the Rolls Royce Group or Fabergé and other high net worth individuals. Lovely people, but I want to do it with mom and dad. I don't want to do it with my sisters. I want to do it with my friends. That's what I want out of life. So you need to earn it yourself to be able to do that.
So what was your next step then? What was your next thinking? You're like, right, I need to, if I'm going to earn this, I need to start my own thing. Or what was the thinking behind this?
Yeah, I felt a little bit guilty ringing your dad, who's out at 7 a.m. cleaning up pig shit and, you know, injecting cattle and walking through the fields, and you're going to play a round of golf in Vegas or going on a boat in Monaco. Seems just a bit ick. And I hated it because I couldn't give back to. I was earning enough to have fun, but not enough to help my mom and dad. And even though they've never put one ounce of pressure, and they probably hate me saying this, there is so much guilt in my shoulders that I'm the first son not to take over the farm. And I'm doing everything in my power to be able to help my mom and dad retire a little bit earlier, because I just feel guilty that I'm the only son who didn't help dad get off the farm. And that's really where I knew I had to start my own thing. And I can go into the ideation part of it and how it got started and what I saw, if you want.
Yeah, absolutely. Bring me to that, because the biggest stumbling block I see for a lot of aspiring entrepreneurs is the zero to one piece. They maybe have the idea, but they never take the step because they're not sure, oh, when's the right time? How do I do it? They always stumble between the zero to one. So take me from the zero to one piece, where you got the original idea, and then what exactly you did to get it going.
Okay. Now, bear in mind, I have six really good years of high level networking at this stage, where I'm like a couple of connections away from very influential people that can help you get started. So I was on the under 30s committee of the NED. It's a members club and hotel in London, quite well known if you live in London, part of the Soho House group. And on the under 30s committee, there was a girl called Melissa Lester, who's now become one of my best friends. She is a venture capitalist for Dig Ventures, which Ross Mason from MuleSoft set up after sold Salesforce. And Melissa had said to me that you really need to get into tech and startups. And this isn't something you speak at the kitchen table back in Ireland on the farm about startups and venture capitalists in Silicon Valley, right? It's something that you have to kind of travel the world to find out a bit more about. And Melissa put me forward to join the Founders of the Future Fellowship, which was set up by Brent Haberman of Founders Forum. He did lastminute.com. And it's kind of, I would say it's like the YC of the UK, maybe a bad analogy, but people might get what I'm saying there. And it was my first foray into the world of software. And the thing that really stood out for me was I looked at my dad and I looked at like his input versus his output. He can work all the hours that God gives him in the week, but he's limited by the amount of land he has. His output is capped. I always wondered, why does he work so hard and he doesn't make the money other people made? It kind of confused me because he works more than anyone. And you're always taught in school, right? The harder you work, the more that will come your way. But it wasn't happening there. But with software as a business model, I was like, right, so I can, and I dumbed it down in my head. Little did I know, you build this one piece of software and you can scale it infinitely around the world. And that was like a magical business model where the input versus output just to me made sense. You can put all the hours into your week and you can scale it infinitely. And whatever way I'm wired, I have a mindset of going big. I don't enjoy things small. Like to me, what we've done so far is so tiny. We haven't even scratched the surface. Whereas like maybe some of my family members can't even still comprehend where we're at this stage. So being in Founders of the Future Fellowship, again, was just brilliant because I got to network. I met my CTO through it. I'm not a technical founder, so the CTO there was technical, and we started talking about, you know, how we would build the product. And that was really just putting me into a position where I was around people who were also starting companies. Mm. And then we had the network effect of it was one of the more well-known incubators in London. So that's where the ideation where the kickstart came from.
Was that like an incubator program? You did it for 12 weeks and you got together and you just threw ideas against the wall? Or how did the idea come from?
Well, the idea was, to some extent, it was always there. I'm not sure the last time you've been in a hotel, but I'd worked in the hotel industry. And, you know, being Irish, I'm all about hospitality. But I never understood when hoteliers said that hospitality is all about the human touch. But then I looked at some of the processes like check-in, and it's actually like taking out a mortgage. You know, you queue up behind people, you hand over your passport, hand over your credit card, sign a piece of paper, get a plastic key card, go to your room. If you want breakfast in your room, you fill out a piece of paper and hang it on your door. Like, it's all so backwards. And we live in a day today where you can get everything from a couple of taps of your phone. It just made no sense that we weren't using technology in hotels. So it was always there. The bigger problem I was trying to solve was actually that two companies own distribution of rooms globally, which is Booking.com and Expedia. We call them OTAs in our industry, online travel agencies. And they take anywhere from 15 to 25% commission just because you book through a different domain on a website rather than booking through the hotel's website. To me, that's the big vision we're trying to solve. We're just starting with the digitalization of the guest experience. So the idea was always there. Being part of Founders of the Future gave me the network and the knowledge to actually kick on and start.
So this is what you'd seen in your personal experience from Brussels, from Chicago, from London. These are things that you had seen and kind of noted down in your head going, okay, this is a problem.
Yeah. So when you're starting any business, like everything is against you on day one, like a million things. And if you can tick one, two, three things off that reduce the risk of failure, I think that's a wise thing to do. So I knew my industry, I knew the problem, and I had a huge network in the industry to get it started. So all of a sudden, I could get clients pretty much immediately to test this, or I could at least have conversations with hotel managers and general managers across the world because of our alumni at Shannon College of Hotel Management. And instantly, I could speak to 50 people and get some product feedback on it. So I really suggest, yeah, for me, and I'm biased because I'm a first-time founder and I can't tell you how other people do it. I'm just telling you my opinion. But I think if you can do something that you really, truly know and don't just come up with an idea for the sake of coming up with an idea, just so you can call yourself an entrepreneur. It's pretty shit, by the way, as I'm sure you see as well. But try at least have a few things in your favor before you kick it off.
So February 2020, bring me back. It was you. Had you found your co-founder yet?
Yeah, pretty terrible start. February 2020, we raised £100,000 at the time from three board members of FTSE 100 companies that I knew through my network. They all put in a third. It was on a piece of paper and an idea. So I suppose in essence, it was a bit of belief in me from them knowing me for the last few years. Jin was my CTO. I'm going to be co-founder at the time. 2 weeks before March, COVID hit. So all the hotels that we'd agreed that we could maybe start doing some testing with once we built the product had shut down. And then Jin sadly passed away in early March of 2020.
Gosh, so sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it was obviously tough. Came out of nowhere. Not something you expect. I didn't know him massively well a couple of months. You don't have a choice, right? We moved on. You have to move on. And I would say I made a year's worth of mistakes after that. I think I felt pressure when Jin passed away that other people had given me money. And now I needed to figure out a way to how to get this product live. And I'm not a software engineer. At the time, I really didn't know anything about engineering or building a tech product. So I started working with an agency, which for me was the single worst thing I possibly could have done. And for the course of the next 12 months, I sat in hotel lobbies thinking it was launch day and the product never worked. We went into a legal case with the agency. It was the worst first year you could think of, between my co-founder passing away, COVID closing down all our hotels, the product never working, and going into a legal case with the agency.
Wow. All in 1 year. And when you think back to that, like that year, like none of us knew anything, right? You didn't know, is this here for good? Is this here for 2 weeks, 10 weeks, 12 weeks? To be building a hospitality company in that time and to face the challenges you had, how did you stick with it? Because I think that's the people always talk about, like, oh, you know, you meet so many entrepreneurs, what are the characteristics? And I always say it's they have the dog in them. They have just that ability to just, no, I'm keeping going. Talk me through that. How did you stick with it?
Yeah, I hate people who complain. Like, I just don't see what benefit you get out of it. Like, I go to the extremes to say, like, I love my parents and family more than anything. Such a family guy. If something tragic was to happen tomorrow, like, I have to get up the next day and get on with it. Everyone has their own shit going on. And if you just complain, you're not getting anywhere with it. So I just really don't like complaining, first and foremost. My team will say that more than anyone. Like, don't bring complaints to Mark. So you just have to get on with it. You know, no one's here to support you when you really break it down. It's kind of you. So that's just, I don't know if that's good parenting. Like, my parents always taught me, like, the value of hard work, the value of money. You know, if you want your football boots, get out there and work on the farm. And, you know, I used to hand in my hours to my dad and I'd get my couple of euros back. And sometimes we'd go 50-50 on the football boots. But that was just great training. At the time, you hate it, right? You're a kid. And you're like, why do you make me do this?
But it makes no sense at the time. But now when you look back, and I've become a parent in December, and now you look back at the things your parents did and you're like, God, that was just good grounding. That was just good earning the value of a euro or of a pound. Like, it's phenomenal. Like, it gives you great insights. Then as a parent, you're going, okay, this is how hopefully you raise them with good morals and good ethics. And most of all, a good work ethic. And you said there about complaining. I'm the exact same. I don't talk about the weather anymore. I refuse to in Ireland because it's such an Irish thing. Yeah. I just refuse. I just don't want to talk about it. I heard a great phrase, complaining is like a hobby horse. It gives you something to do, but you don't actually go anywhere. It's just pointless.
You also realize you live in Ireland. Like, it'd be different in Dubai. We're here and we're talking about the rain. That might make sense.
Yes.
You live in Ireland.
Unless it's a blizzard or a heat wave, I really have no interest because it's generally going to be, you know, you're kind of fairly sure what it's going to be. Yeah. So you didn't complain. You just stuck with it. But bring me through that process, because I think that's the bit I'd love to explore a little bit more with you, because you seem incredibly self-assured and incredibly confident. And as a founder, that can be so bloody tough, because on the outside, you have to appear like you. You have to be, yes, this is happening. But on the inside, you can be like, whoo, not sure what's going on here.
Yeah. I think it came from my mum or my mum's dad. It was like, join the army, do the marching. I'm just a big believer in that. I think when you take another pound of someone else's money, you give away the right to complain or give up or sometimes say you're having a bad day. And, you know, we've not talked about it, but I've raised $20 million now of other people's money. Like, let's get it right, anyone who's listening. It's not my money. Mark's not a millionaire. Let's not talk like that. It goes straight to the business. I have about $2,000 in my bank account. So it's other people's money that I've been given to go and achieve my dreams. Like, think how audacious it is to even say that. And then to think you have the right to complain or have the right to say you want to work-life balance or you want to work remote and finish at 5 o'clock and have the weekends off. Like, it's utter load of bullshit, the rhetoric that's in the kind of startup ecosystem right now. It's work-life balance. If you want work-life balance, just get a normal life. Don't take 20 million quid of other people's money and ask for it. So I think you just need to reframe that. Like, I owe every ounce of my body to go on this journey and never give up until the day they ask me to leave because I'm not a good enough CEO, or we just run out of capital and it all breaks. But I'll never not be able to shake my investors' hands, look them in the eye and say, I died for this. That's one thing I'll never not be able to do. And I think that's why, like, I've went through times over the last 2 years where investors had to come in and give me some bridge financing before we got to the place we could do the Series A. And I would say if you were to interview them, they'd probably say, it's because I know he'll never give up.
Mm-hmm. And at the end of the first year, how did you turn that corner? Because it sounds like you had multiple setbacks there. What was the turning point, or was there one, or was it just a series of not stopping?
There literally is never a turning point, Gary. Like, I think I've had like the worst 2 weeks since I started the company and we just raised 15 million quid. So I don't think there's a turning point. There's a little bit of naive optimism, they call us. You know, like, if you were to know how hard it is to actually climb Everest, you might never attempt it. But when you're 3/4 of the way up, it's just, you just keep going, right? But if you'd known how much of a challenge it was going to be, would any sane person even start it? Probably not.
So I'll rephrase then. How did you go from having no product, having a lawsuit with the agency, having no technical founder, to having a product that's now raised over 20 million?
Okay. I would say first and foremost, when you're starting out and you're looking at creating your team, you might think you're solving the biggest problem and you've got the greatest team. If you cannot sell to investors and pitch a vision and get people to believe in what you could one day do, you have no chance. Like, it's so critical to be able to articulate your vision in simple words that get someone excited at the other side of the phone. And fortunately, whether it's the gift of the gab or whatever way you want to call it, I listen to a lot of Jordan Peterson. I think he helps me formulate my words. I listen to a lot of podcasts, people like yourself. Just the more you're ingesting, the kind of more you're able to expand your vocab. And it might sound so simple, but at the end of the day, you're just a person sitting in front of another person, convincing them to believe in you. And that's pitching. And at the start of pre-seed or seed, or even, to be honest, some of Series A, a lot of it is what you're going to do, not what you've done. I'm not telling you to just build a business to raise money, but that is such a critical part of the early days. Because when you look at our product, we actually have, we call it software as a service, SaaS. We actually have 5 pieces of software and a payments company in one company. So we need an order of magnitude more engineers than most companies who might be doing one single piece of functionality or feature, because we're trying to solve a really, really massive problem that, if it's successful, will be the biggest travel company since Airbnb. But the likelihood is that it will fail, right? That's kind of what venture is all about. You know, small chance of success, but if you get through that success barrier, you're one of the biggest companies. So we just needed more capital. How did, like, if I talk about now the actual mechanics of doing that, 100K, in my opinion, wasn't enough, especially with what happened post that. I was very fortunate to meet William McQuillan from Frontline Ventures. It's an Irish-born venture capital company, definitely the most well-known. It's in London and San Fran as well. William's an incredible guy. We met, my cousin, Richard Mahaney, initially introduced me to him. Richard had been in the tech world for many great companies. And William said no 3 times to me. First time, he just said no on the email. Second time, no on the email. Maybe even 4 times. Third time, I might have got him on a call. And I'd iterated the pitch and the presentation a little bit. Finally, in March of 2021, I had signed up two hotels on a better idea, I would say, just like a more thought through idea of what I was, the problem I was solving. I'd got like 100, 200 failures of like pitching the wrong way. And you know yourself, all of a sudden you get a rebuttal and you answered a bit better and you refine your pitch. And then I went in and I was able to nail it. Luckily, William's son is called Atlas. So he's a big fan of travel as well. So yeah, William McQuillan and Frontline Ventures like have everything to thank them for. They believed in me. They led a $5 million series or seed round. A guy called Nick Bateau, who I met when I was in Lisbon, was the global head of recruitment for Uber. And this is where I'll talk about the network effect. Nick was global head of recruitment for Uber during their really crazy period. He introduced me to the founder of Lime, Brad Bow, then the founder of Lime Invested. Brad introduced me to the founder of Checkout.com. He invested. Then the CTO of Pinterest invested. Then the CTO of Lime invested. Then the CTO of Uber invested. So from one connection, I went from like nothing to having the most insane cap table of people. The CTO of Workday, David Clark, an Irish guy, who built some of the biggest businesses in the world. It was pretty bonkers.
It's a while. I'm getting real professional. I do research on the companies and guests now. And I was writing this down yesterday on my left-hand side of a Notion doc here. Founder of Checkout.com, co-founder of Lime.com, head of engineering at Pinterest. Founder, and I was writing all these down and I was going, what the hell? So you stole one of my questions there. I was like, so one led to the other. It was one intro led to the next, to the next, to the next. And are you asking, are you going, okay, well, who should I speak to next? Or how are you doing this? Because I think it's an art and a science. Networking is definitely an art and a science. How do you approach it and how do you think about it?
So first, you got to realize that no one owes you anything and you really got to make it worth someone's time. And if I'm sending a cold email or a cold LinkedIn message, I'll always look to see if it's like two or three personal things that we can get in order for like to kick them into either nearly blackmailing them into a reply. So like with hotel managers, if I see they went to the Shannon College of Hotel Management, I'll say, oh, you know, we're both Irish. We both went to Shannon. I'm sure we can share some war stories. I see you're working at Sofitel. I actually used to work there. And all of a sudden there's like a couple of commonalities. And then I'll say, listen, I know you're so busy and like I'm just nobody who's just come out of nowhere to ask you for some time. But if you can spare 30 minutes, would love to have a chat, but aware you're going to say no. And you kind of take the no away from them and you kind of like nearly push them into having to reply. So I think I'd rather, and I say it to people who join us in sales, I'd rather you send like 10 to 20 really bespoke messages every single day than send like 100, hi, I'm Mark, buy my product, please. Yeah. It just doesn't work. In actual fact, Nick will laugh. Nick started his own company from Uber afterwards. And when he saw the way I do the responses, when he introduces me to an investor, he was like, whoa, I need to up my game.
Nice.
Because I just put thoughtful responses into it. I might read some of their blogs that they did and say, hey, I see you wrote this blog a few months ago. I really like that point on two-sided marketplaces. This is actually we're trying to do a Shackle. You've just done it. Like it takes 5 minutes to make something so more impressive than just like, hi, Nick, thanks for the intro. Hey, Gary, when can we chat?
Yeah, I hate it. And I've done a whole episode on it, like why I won't meet people for coffee, because I get so many messages going, hey, Gary, can we hop on a quick call? And you're like, absolutely not. I can think of a million things I'd rather be doing than hopping on a blind, no context. You say, and it's psychology, right? It's basic human psychology. If you're asking someone for 30 minutes of their time, which is the most valuable thing they own will ever own in the world, is 30 minutes. And you're not giving them any reason, any context, any effort that you've spent at least, like you say, 5-10 minutes just understanding who they are. They're not just throwing shit against a wall, hoping some of it will stick.
So that's it. So, you know, like even I do my own podcast now with hotel managers. And after I do the podcast with the hotel manager, I'll ask them to introduce me to three hotel managers to bring on the podcast. And now you can see at the matrix. So, you know, so but then when you're there, I think I was actually not great at pitching at the start. Like, so if you're a founder right now or you're an entrepreneur and you're looking to speak to people, whether that be trying to get a co-founder on or hire a new employee, like it does take time to craft the pitch. So like, don't be too hard on yourself. What I would say to Irish people specifically is stop self-deprecating. We're so bad at it in Ireland. You are against American founders. And William told me this from Frontline. We're against American founders who go, we can take over the world. And you're like, I'm Irish. I'm all right at it. I'm not great. Like I made a load of mistakes. Like I'm pretty shy actually. With the greatest respect, like you have to see this as like you're going in for an acting audition. And you're trying to convince someone to go, well, I give this young 20-something, 30-something, if you are whatever age, millions of dollars and do I trust them that they can execute? Because really what an investor wants to do, despite what they say about value add, is I want to give this kid 10 million quid and I want him to 100x it, and I probably never want to have to do a phone call with him to teach him about anything.
Exactly.
That's what they really want.
Yeah.
They don't actually want to value add and help you. They want to trust you. So like I used to add in small things at the end where I'd say like two things will happen after this. One, you'll either have Shackle on your website as the biggest investment you've ever made, or the next time you're on a podcast and someone asks you, what's your biggest miss? You'll think of that Irish kid from 10 years ago. Like that leaves them with a bit, fuck.
I like that, because you're setting it forward. You're going, here's what's going to happen. And it's that surety piece of like, you know, you're asking someone for millions of euro and it's exactly like you say, do I want to give it to somebody who's going, well, you know, Asher, maybe, you know, I don't know. Like, it's a big difference between self-deprecating and kind of honesty. I think honesty is brilliant, but the self-deprecating thing is, I agree with you 1000% on that. We have to get a little bit better at going.
It's not about being arrogant either, right? Like there's a fine line. Like, yes, be arrogant, of course, you know. You'll figure out how you do it.
How did you solve the tech piece?
Yeah,
you had early challenges with the tech piece, and that's a lot of founders are like, you know, it's a great idea, but I can't find a tech co-founder. How did you solve that?
Okay, so to save myself a year and a half of pain, I would have just stopped, paused, and gone and got another co-founder who was a CTO. My mistake, you roll with the punches. It didn't happen. So fortunately, once we had done the seed round and we had about 5 million quid in the bank, I was able to actually get a recruitment company in. We used a company called Orange Quarter in Amsterdam. My COO, who joined as an investor, was at Uber, and he was in Amsterdam. We had someone on customer success who was at Uber. They were in Amsterdam. So we started to like hire within Amsterdam, and Orange Quarter, a great recruitment company there. So I would say if you got the money, use a recruitment company, especially if you're not a technical founder, because you don't know how you're speaking to them. Like you don't know if what you're asking is right.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Don't kid yourself. And we found a guy called Misha, who was 10 years at Booking.com as one of their directors of engineering, and then a year Getir as a director of engineering. And he'd scaled Getir from like 40 to 400 engineers. Getir is like a $7 billion business at the time. 10 years at Booking.com, which is a company we wanted to beat. He actually started their first mobile app within Booking.com. It was a bit of a no-brainer, and he changed everything for us. He brought a full in-house team. We've got some of the most amazing engineers now. Our senior product managers just came from Kareem and Bold and Omnipresent. Our other product manager came from Blinkist and Soho House. Again, because if you can get someone like Misha in, who's got such a big network as well at the top, all of a sudden people want to come to work for us because he's the CTO. So like I can put on the sale and get them excited about the vision and being the biggest travel company since Airbnb. And now they're like, oh, I'm excited to join this journey. But then they speak to their ultimate manager and they're like, wow, I can learn so much from this guy.
So you were able to raise, did you say 5 million without a technical co-founder?
Yeah, so here's a little hack I would give to founders. Matt Cleverly is our VP of marketing now. He was a friend who I met in many years ago. He started doing a bit of graphic design at me. He was the first person I kind of really told about Shackle. And we met in a coffee shop in Fulham and he just started designing decks for me because like it's so much easier to present off something visual. And what me and Matt did for the year after Jin sadly passed away, when we knew we weren't going to have a product live, is we got a Figma demo and we just built out the app on Figma and presented that to hotels as if it was built, and then signed contracts and then used those contracts to raise money to hire engineers to actually build the product and then do some like damage control during the period of time it took to build the product before we'd go live.
Love that. That is superb. That is that's getting clipped right away and going for TikTok. That is super. I had a great young Irish co-founder or Irish founder on a few weeks ago, Charlie from Bounce Insights, and that is exactly what he was saying as well. He wishes that he'd listened, sold, built. And that's exactly what you did. You listened, you sold, you built. And like, it's so counterintuitive though to what people want to do. People want to build the perfect thing and want to present hotels with the perfect solution. Whereas in reality, you did the perfect playbook. So you built it out in Figma as if it was already there and then sold it into the hotels with a lead time of manufacture. Is that correct?
Yes. He probably articulated it a lot better than I did. But what actually happened, and you know, in hindsight, looking back, is we didn't just pitch to one person and they signed up and we got a client. We pitched it to like 100 people and they all gave us feedback and we were iterating on the demo as the feedback would come in and said, why don't you have upselling? Why don't you have room service? Why don't you have chat? Why don't you have this here? And all of a sudden, without having to speak to engineers and waste money and rebuild, you're just changing designs on a Figma demo and you're learning so much more. And then finally someone says yes. So yeah, that's what we did in essence.
Beautiful.
It wasn't tactical, by the way. It was just like, if we have to do it. Like Jin had passed away. We were running out of money. VCs were saying they want to see a few contracts. We were just pushed into doing it. I'm not going to take kudos for having this bright spark idea.
But out of necessity comes brilliance, right? You know, out of, you know, you probably wouldn't have done it that way. You probably would have prolonged yourself and burned a lot of cash the other way. So you raised 100K, then you went back, signed a few contracts, and then raised 5 million?
Yeah. Well, I suppose what I'm trying to get at there is that, you know, my girlfriend has started a company and started another company, and she can sometimes be hard on herself. And she's incredibly intelligent, so hardworking. But I just say to people, like, don't be too hard on yourself. Like, I've met some of the biggest entrepreneurs in the world who built the biggest companies, now they're investors. They're just normal people. They just kept going. They just kept grinding. They didn't complain. They just kept working. Like, I'm here today because I just kept going. So I think everyone thinks you have to be this like insane genius to do it. You really don't. So like, just don't be hard on yourself. Just keep going. But yeah, we can get into that. We got to 5 million. We're able to build out a team. We still made a lot of, like, over the last year, like Misha joined in January 2022. We went kind of live in May of 2022, really. We had like a bit of an MVP product in November of 2021 just to keep the client somewhat happy. But we could only actually work with 5% of our guests. Might be wise to tell people a little bit about the product now, just before I kind of get to
technical with the product mistakes we made.
Exactly. Yeah. What did you launch?
So to give you a little bit of oversight first, we split travel into three parts: the book part, the stay part, and the explore part. If I was asking you to think of companies that own the stay part of travel, you'd probably say booking.com. Sorry, the book part of travel, you'd probably say booking.com or Expedia. If I was asking you to come up with companies that own the explore part of travel, you might say Get Your Guide or TripAdvisor. But if I ask you to think of a brand that owns the 2 or 3 or 4 days you're staying in a hotel, there's just no brand that owns that, right? It's a physical experience. You arrive at the hotel after your flight and most of the time you queue up. But when I look at it, you've got what, 30, 40 minutes on booking.com looking at hotels before you book, maybe 40 minutes to an hour planning what things you might do on the day, but you're actually in the hotel for 24, 36, 72, however many hours it is. It's the longest time you can build a relationship with a user. And that's what we started with. So the stay experience is the first thing we want to digitalize. And when you think of that is right now, physically, like I said at the start, you physically queue up, physically hand over your stuff, like your passport, your credit card. You want to order room service, you pick up the phone and you speak and you ask for someone. You want to book a restaurant, you pick up the phone. If you want to check out, you go back to the desk and check out. So what we do right now is we just digitalize everything from the app. So you can check in, upload your passport, pay for the room, open up your room door, order room service, talk to the front desk, add upsells, check out, pay your bill. The difference with us is we don't white label for the hotel. So it's not like it's Jumeirah Group's app and Dalata's app and Millennium's app and Marriott's app. Because then as users, we really look at the guest. Means the guest has 100 different hotel apps.
Yeah.
We don't think they want that. We think they want the Deliveroo or Uber Eats model, or it's one app for all restaurants. And that's what we're building. Much harder to build it, but we think that's what, if we get to scale, the network effect will come into play. And that's why I say we'd be the biggest travel company since Airbnb. Because eventually what we want to do is, once we have enough density of hotels in each city, we bring in the capability for you to book the hotel. So the difference in user experience then, well, when you press book hotel with us, you're automatically checked in and your digital key pops up the day you arrive, no different than your boarding pass does.
Beautiful.
And you can book your things to do in the city and everything's in one platform versus the messy, you know, process it is right now. And that's ultimately what we want to do.
I love that because I travel quite a bit and there's so much friction, just small friction things of exactly like you outlined there, you know, just the silly things of like, I always wonder, like, queue up to book at checkout and I'm like, why am I doing this? Like, this makes no sense to queue up behind 10 people, to hand them the key and go, thanks very much, today was lovely, bye. And like, it just makes no sense. Whereas you say, like, there's no, you want it to be seamless, right? You want it to be relaxing and seamless. Like travel can be stressful. You know, if you're going to an airport, you know, you go through all the hoopla's of this, that, and the other. And you said it exactly there. People don't want more apps. They don't want more loyalty cards. They don't want more of this. They're so used to having one or two master apps. And if you build that for travel, it really will be the biggest company since Airbnb.
Yeah, it's funny you say it. You said the frictionless. Our last product roadmap was called the frictionless app. We're just taking things out of the onboarding process to make it more seamless. But yeah, that's in essence what we want to do. Like, I'm still a big believer in the personal touch with hospitality. I just don't think someone who comes from London to Dubai after a 7-hour flight with their kids wants to then get their bags and then go to the hotel and queue up for 20 minutes before they're allowed into the room. I just don't think that adds to the personal experience. I think meeting them at the car and saying, "Hey, Gary, welcome. I see your daughter, Willow, I believe it is.
Exactly.
Like, let me walk you up to your room. I see you've already checked in." You're like, wow, that's so much nicer.
Exactly.
They know my name.
Because it's personal.
Straight to the room.
Exactly. Because it's the extra personal touch. Oh, you know, here's your high chair. You know, little things like that, especially as you go through different stages of life, you realize there is friction. And I had Ray Nolan on a few weeks ago. Phenomenal entrepreneur. My God. But he just kept talking about simplicity, breaking everything down in simplicity. We make things so complicated, especially in tech. People love to make things so difficult. When in reality, you need to make it less difficult. That's the whole point. If you're dealing for consumers, which you are, you want simplicity because you know, whatever can go wrong will go wrong, right? Especially in travel, you know yourself. People do strange things. So you really need to factor in that. So talk to me then about where you are right now, because you've just raised a phenomenal amount of money. Your most recent raise was for how much?
We do it in dollars now, so $15 million.
So it's very sizable. You know, that is, especially considering the world we're in now and especially the travel sector after what's gone on the last couple of years. That is phenomenal. So I think you have to celebrate those wins as well. I know to you, that's not, you know, you're like not celebrating a fundraise. And I think that's admirable as well. But you have to look at these signals and go, okay, there's something here with Shackle. So where is Shackle today in November 2023?
Yeah. So I don't say celebrate it because it's just not the end of the journey, right? And if anything, it's just more pressure. I think Ray might have said it. I listened to it. It's just not the right thing to celebrate. It really isn't. So in essence of where we are today, we're still way behind where I need us to be. Like, that's the funny thing about it. Like, we raised the capital, but we're just not where I want us to be yet. Maybe that's me being a bit of a perfectionist or whatever. But we're in New York. We're in London. We're waiting to go live in Dubai. We've over 100 hotels signed up to the platform. And our big thing is getting the product live. About 10 live today. But some of the groups we have are pretty impressive and we have contracts with them. When you go up to that front desk, the computer at the desk is called a property management system. And then you've got the key card that gets you into the door, and that's a door lock system. So our team not only has to build the consumer app that has all of the front end functionality that you will see as a consumer, but we have to integrate with the property management system, integrate with the lock provider. And then we have different payments systems all across the world. And our fintech product is probably going to be our biggest release next year. And then you have to pay for your room. So we have a huge amount of integrations. We're actually kind of like an integration company, which people don't see from the outside looking in. So we really needed to hire like 15 more engineers to scale the amount of integrations we needed to do to actually onboard those hotels in order to unlock the revenue.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where we're at right now. We're doing those integrations to unlock the revenue. But we've got some incredible, like in New York, we work with the biggest owner of hotels in New York City. We work with the Montcalm Group in London. We've got Rixis down here in Dubai, part of Accor Group. So, you know, everyone said to me, like, you wouldn't sign up 5-star hotels because they wouldn't want to use technology. And then you wouldn't get any nice brands or bigger brands because they would want to use their own app. And I think we've discounted a lot of that, you know, or disproved that over the last kind of year.
When it comes to it, people will want the best solution. They will want the best, especially if they're 5-star hotels. They're going to want the best solution. And if Shackle is the best solution for making their experience better, they will want Shackle. So where are you based? Like, where's your team based? Because you talked about Amsterdam, London, Dubai, New York. Where is your actual team working out of? Because I know we talked about this in our very first call about hybrid working, remote working, you know, managing a team. How does that look like for you?
Yeah, so I hate remote working. I really do, especially for a company of our stage and size, when you're really about listening to user feedback, listening to customers, iterating the product. I just don't think it works. We have to be remote for obvious reasons over the last few years. We've got an office now in London. We've got an office in Dubai. We had an office in Amsterdam, but we're relocating everyone down to Dubai, and we'll just have Dubai and London as our two core offices. And I'm just not a fan of remote work. It's just not for me.
So how do you, you know, you're a young guy, you're probably running at 100% now. How are you looking after yourself outside of business? Because I like to talk about the business, the brain and the body. So how do you look after yourself?
Yeah, I was a bit of an idiot in London, you know, so I wasn't always like this. I was probably partying way too much in the cool group in London and just kind of like wasting whatever talents I had. So, you know, I did those years in London, complete waste. Glad I got out of it. So I don't really drink that much anymore at all. And I think that kills you no matter what anyone says. We're all Irish. We love to have a drink, right? It's kind of in our nature. But it just ruins you. And like for me, I thought, right, I'm coming in on a Monday morning. If I've not recovered and I'm getting on my sales update call or my customer success update call or my marketing update call, my product update call, and I'm in a negative mood because of the weekend, and then I'm projecting that onto my team, it's not really a great leader, is it? Like I'm stressed enough as it is and I have high demands and, you know, I'm tough on them as it is. So to add not recovering at the weekend onto that is just unfair on my team. And then, like I said before, I've taken other people's money. So like I'll have a drink once a quarter-ish now. You know, as in when I mean like have a drink, you know, you're hungover the next day. Let's be honest, right? You can have a glass of wine every now and then. So not into alcohol or partying anymore. Cut that out completely, pretty much. I work out every single day, sometimes twice a day. Everything, I love my boxing, running, paddle over here in Dubai, tennis, weights, eat pretty clean, drink a lot of water. Biggest thing I found over the last few months has been those electrolytes, actually.
Are they good? Like a baby, yeah, you see now, them coming, like, oh, you see them getting really popular, yeah. Especially out there, I'd imagine.
I think like we're massively dehydrated. I don't think we realize how much it impacts us. Listen, I'm not into the whole you have to get up at 5 a.m. and get into your ice bath and meditate for 20 minutes. And if you don't do that, you're not going to succeed. Like, it's a little bit anal, let's be honest, and no one really believes it. So I'm not into that, but I just think look after yourself, right? It's just common sense. Like, don't eat shitty food.
Yeah.
Don't eat sweets the whole time. Don't drink that much. Try get a good sleep. It's not rocket science.
Like, what does your day look like? What is a normal inverted commas for an entrepreneur? What does that look like?
Mate, like, I don't even know what's happening this afternoon. That's why I'd say like emotional control, which I'm not always great at, is very important, because like it's not good days and bad days. It's like a good hour, a bad hour, a good 20 minutes, a bad 20 minutes. A good 1 minute, a bad 1 minute. You know, we raised the round and the next day I got a phone call from one of our biggest clients saying they want to drop us, you know? It's supposed to be the big cool moment, right? Like, I saved it, but like, you go from a high to a low. You can't control that, you're screwed. So a typical day, there's no real such thing. I don't want to give a bad answer, but there really isn't. And, you know, I'm going to Saudi Arabia next week to Riyadh. I didn't know that last week, so next week's changed. I try to do as many hotel meetings as possible with hotel managers. That's actually my favorite, like being with hotel managers, learning about the industry even more, like getting their feedback on the product. I love sales, like, so it's still in me. I'm a glorified sales exec, really. You can have a CEO title. I'm just a sales exec. I'm not so good at the people management stuff because I don't like complaining and what I think is fluffiness. I need to get better out of it. I'm pretty aware of that. But like, you know, I look at some people in my team and they earn more than my mom and dad combined. I'm like, why complain? Like, come on, give me a break. About small things. And my team is amazing, but I just can't, I'm not great at it. So I like to stay in front of my hotels. Investors, I don't have to do so much anymore. I love product. I like being in the product meetings about what we're going to build, how we're going to build it, how we're going to bring it to life. I love that. I love the marketing meetings. I have one-to-ones with the team every week with all the leaders for the various different departments. I enjoy those. But the day differs so, so much every single day.
When we sit down again in 2 years' time to the next episode of this, what are we going to be looking at with Shackle? Because I know you're very driven. I know you've very big plans. Where will we be in 2 years?
I think the job now is to, this is like a weird one. When you're starting out, you feel like you have to do everything. And like you have to put more stuff on your pitch deck to raise money. And I remember when I used to map out the world on the pitch deck and like we'd signed up hotels and Lisbon and Miami and New York and LA and Ireland and England. And I was like, look, we're a global company already. And then again, silly me, like, you know, focus is everything. And you really need to do that. So I think it's actually focusing over the next 2 years, really going like deep market penetration in the countries that we are in. The big focus for us will be UK, Ireland, and Dubai. Getting Dubai is massively important for us. We have a partnership with Dubai Tourism to take guest identity. So passports basically within the app and send it straight to the police over here. It's a legal requirement to hand your passport over at the desk. They scan it at the desk and it gets sent to the police. Therefore, you can't do a digital check-in in any hotel in Dubai. So we've got one of the first partnerships with the government to be able to take guest passports and send it directly through an API from our app, which is massive. And we really need to take advantage of that. So that means like going hard here. And unfortunately, I hate saying it, but we have gone down the venture capital route. So like the maths are pretty simple. We need anywhere from 6 to 10 million in annual recurring revenue in order to do our Series B. Like raising money is not that hard. It's actually executing that's hard. The facts and figures are there. You know what you need to hit. You know what you need to achieve. Frontline are an incredible investor, and they've given me a lot of insight. And Silver Stripe, led by Alex Cuppage, who's our new Series A lead investor. They know all of the big Series B funds. And like, I have my first board meeting with them next Tuesday, and we have a plan tracked back from the day we run out of money 6 months before where we need to be at in order to raise our next round of capital. And it's all about execution. So I think it's just focus and execution. Being very transparent, we need anywhere from 6 to 10 million in ARR. Or I think 6 million, it'll be more of a tougher sell. 10 million, you'll have people throwing checks at you. And that's it. It's not rocket science.
Make it sound so simple. Let's get to our quick fire round. What book would you recommend every entrepreneur should read?
Pretty sad one, because Chuck Feeney was my hero, and Chuck changed the way I view life in a lot of ways. And if I am fortunate enough to be successful, I want to track back first and foremost, like mom and dad, help them retirement, look after my sister, look after my girlfriend and her friend. And then I want to do this weird thing where I'm going to go to like my play school and look after them financially. I'm going to go to my primary school. I'm going to go to my secondary school. I'm going to go to my sports teams. I'm going to go to my university, and then I'm going to go wider with it. But I want to like track back my life, everything that led up to where I am, to the person I am, and try give back in whatever way they need at the time. So Chuck definitely inspired that. For anyone who doesn't know Chuck Feeney and you're Irish, that's a disgrace, in my opinion. The man is, he was a living legend. Sadly, he passed away not so long ago, but the billionaire who wasn't.
Perfect.
Chuck Feeney, it's just, yeah, he's just a legend.
What's something you didn't pay enough attention to early on and had to learn the hard way?
Yeah, I said I'm good at networking, but I'm still growing and maturing and learning. So there's probably some relationships I may have burnt in the past, and the world is small and you just don't know when you might need that relationship or it comes full circle. I would say like just, yeah, try not burn bridges. You know, life and the world is not as big as you think. Everyone kind of knows everyone. Yeah, I just wish I wasn't so flippant when I was a bit younger. I have a tendency, like I can cut people off or something I need to work on. But yeah, just think a bit more long-term, I think.
Okay.
It's good self-awareness, at least.
Learning.
What have you sacrificed to achieve your success?
Not a cheap answer. I genuinely don't think I'm successful yet. And I have not achieved what I want to achieve. Let's say I go a couple more years and it fails. Like I've probably sacrificed pretty much everything if it fails, right? Because I've given up most of my social life. My girlfriend sometimes gets the 1% of me that's left at the end of the day, which isn't fair on her. I don't see my family that much. I work pretty much every hour I'm given. You know, I'm definitely losing years off my life from the travel and the stress and the sleep in different environments. It's just natural. So if it fails, like what a killer. But if it's successful and we do get acquired or go public, the amount of people's lives you can change, unbelievable. So I won't have risked anything then. So you probably will have to ask me that.
It's a good answer. It's nuanced. I like it. You just put a bit of thought into it. That's all that matters. This is going to be a weird answer because you've kind of already flagged it. What would you do today if I give you 10 million euro?
Yeah, I think, you know, like I said, I would hate it, but start that process. Mom and dad retirement, set my sisters up, set my girlfriend and her family up, whatever was left, then go through the ranks of play school, primary school, sports team, secondary school.
Nice.
Universities.
What's something in your daily routine you wish had started sooner?
Sounds stupid. The electrolyte thing, really. I'm I'm serious. It's sleeping like a baby, so much more energy, just the hydration.
What one are they? Do you know? Do you know the brand?
I use some random one in Dubai from a pharmacy that I got, but just ordered Humantra.
Okay, Humantra.
I think a lot of people have seen that one. The one I got in Dubai is probably just specific to the pharmacy, but amazing. Genuinely.
I'm always, they're the little insights, though. It's like you said, it's the fundamentals and the principles. They're always the insights I'm looking for. If I give you 1 million euro today, you can only invest it in one person or company, who would it be?
Yeah, I'm actually not a big investor. I love everything Elon Musk does. I think he's an absolute legend. So just if I got access to like his shareholders day, I'd probably just put it into one of his companies just to get access to being around him and see him in person and hear him in person. I just love him. And I love the way he's just himself. He just doesn't give a shit. I think I'm like, if I ever go on to become a bigger CEO, I definitely want to have the way he lives. He lives, well, quite restricted, quite free in his words, his thinking. And I think that's admirable. A lot of CEOs are not speaking their true mind. They're playing the politics game. They're playing the woke culture. They're not speaking their truth. So I try to be a little bit just honest with who I am. Like, I'm so anti-woke. Do not want any woke people in the company. And I start that early because I don't want to be curtailed with how I think and how I talk when the company gets bigger. And I think he's nailed it.
If you just start a new company in the morning, what would it be?
It's something I will do, which is a hotel brand. So an actual property, looking into it as we speak. So a hotel brand. I think there's room there for a great one. So part of the podcast strategy, getting to interview the best minds in the hotel industry to create the team already.
I love that. I think people are sleeping on podcasts, how powerful they are. What do you believe that other people would strongly disagree with or find strange?
Depends what age you are, but your friends aren't really your friends.
Expand.
They're just acquaintances a lot of the time. My early 20s, mid-20s, a lot of the people I hung out with in London thought they were my best friends. Stopped going to the parties, started working really hard. The messages just stopped dropping off of, hey, where are you? What are you doing? They're not really your friends.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the time. It's by environment. If there's a learning from it, like try not give a shit what people say. But really, I don't think they're really your friends. They're just acquaintances. They're there because of the environment. And that's fine. Acquaintances are great. My dad always said, like, this is your five hands. That's how many close people be around you. And that's all that matters.
Yeah.
But I don't think most friends are actually your friends.
Your friends by circumstance. In your personal life, what's one thing you spend money on that brings you immense joy or happiness?
Yeah, experiences of the people I love.
Beautiful. And what's the final sentence of advice to every entrepreneur listening?
Don't become an entrepreneur if you just want the outcome and not the journey.
Mark, that was super. Thank you so much. Where can people learn more about you and more importantly about Shackle?
Shackle is www.exploreshackle.com. We're quite big on LinkedIn now. So, you know, I posted a lot on LinkedIn. That's probably the best place to connect with me from a business perspective. Share some stuff on Instagram, but, you know, slightly irrelevant. It's just some photos of hotels and business stuff. But LinkedIn, definitely, if you want to actually have a proper chat, just Mark Abraham Shackle. I think it will be there.
Mark, I wish you ever success, and I do look forward to a chat in 2 years' time. Mark, thank you so much.
Gary, thank you. Really appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed that pod with Mark. Wherever you're listening, whether it's Spotify, Apple, or on YouTube, hit that subscribe button. You get 3 brand new podcasts a week. I'll see you back here in a couple of days.